Back in 2012, there was a bus campaign. Let me show you the slide. This was in Australia, and it used a quip from Woody Allen, and you can just about make it out on that bus. If God exists, I hope he has a good excuse. And the topic it's raising is the topic of suffering, which is an important one. And if you're interested in that particular question, do check out the big questions page on the website if that's an issue for you. But the issue I want to draw out of that bus campaign is this instinct, which that quote captures, the instinct that we have to put God on trial, to put God in the dock, where God has to answer to us and give his answers. And C.S. Lewis, the writer, he wrote about this tendency that we have in his book, which is titled God in the Dock. And he said this, I'll put the quote on the screen. He said, "The ancient man approached God, or even the gods, as the accused person approaches his judge. For the modern man, the roles are reversed. He is the judge. God is in the dock. He's quite a kindly judge. If God should have a reasonable defence for being the God who permits war, poverty and disease, he's ready to listen to him. The trial may even end in God's acquittal. But the important thing is that man is on the bench and God is in the dock." Now, the passage we just had read is an extraordinary moment in the history of the world. I mean, it sounds, if it hadn't actually happened, you would think this was the plot of some fantastic kind of crazy story. Because this is the moment in the history of the world when God himself was literally put on trial. Can you imagine that? We saw 2 weeks ago, John, this gospel writer, he's the only one out of the four gospel writers who records that at Jesus's arrest, there were not just Jewish guards, which all the other gospel writers mentioned, but there was also a cohort of Roman Gentile soldiers as well. And it's similar here as Jesus is being tried. John has a much greater stress, not just on the role of the Jewish leadership, but also on Pilate, the Roman Gentile governor's part in Jesus' trial. Because what John is trying to show us, he wants to draw attention to the fact that both Jew and Gentile are united here in our verdict on Jesus. As John put it at the beginning of the gospel, and these might be familiar, verses. He, Jesus, was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world, the whole world, Jew and Gentile, did not know him. This is a universal truth. But this trial that is happening here is unlike any other trial, understandably, because God's involved. And we find that as God is being put in the dock, there's a very strange reversal that happens. And we very quickly discover as we read it that when we try and judge God, actually, our verdict on him bounces back and really becomes a verdict on ourselves. And that's the first point. I think I put it up a bit early. Jesus, the light of the world, exposes our guilt. And there's a couple of ways in which he does it. And the first one I put there, he exposes our supposed goodness. So let's look at the verses again. Then they, and that is the Jewish leaders, then the Jewish leaders led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the Roman governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, would not be unclean, but could eat the Passover. Now, there's a real irony about this fact, about the Jewish leaders' behavior. These leaders are clearly very scrupulous, very pious, and they want to act in line with their principles as closely as they can. In this case, it's not actually a principle from the Bible, it's just a human tradition, but they're adamant that they won't enter a Gentile house because it would make them ceremonially unclean, and then they wouldn't be able to take part in all the Passover festivities. And the irony is that whilst they are scrupulous, very, very careful in one area of morality, as they see it, and they're completely unconcerned about another area of morality, and a much more important one, because they're busy here trying to get an innocent man, the Son of God, no less, killed. They're so concerned in one area about celebrating the Passover festival, verse 28, that they don't mind murdering the true Passover lamb, which the festival points towards. There's this huge irony going on, and we're going to think more about that as we go on. People assume religion is always about sincerity. It's about seeking and worshipping God. But actually, the Bible tells us religion is very often just a convenient device for keeping God off our backs so that we can pursue our own agendas. That's one of the great attractions of religion, actually. We surmise that by working hard for God, we can put him in our debt, as if we bought some credits that effectively buy us the right to feel good about ourselves and maybe even to look down on others. And then we have, we think, a freedom to keep God at arm's length in other ways. And there's a reason why religion is so often associated with smug judgmentalism. It's not an accident. And can I say, it's not just people with a religious label that operate under this kind of framework. In some ways, it seems this religious instinct is actually hardwired in all of us. So it's not that, you know, all modern secular people are complete, you know, total relativists, anything goes. No, modern secular people may have dispensed with a traditional morality in many cases, but invariably another ethical system quickly swoops in to fill the vacuum. Similar, I think, to the way these leaders, that they ignore, push aside God's law, you know, happy to kill an innocent man, but then they create their own traditions to take its place, to make them feel pure and undefiled. The writer Dostoevsky once said, without God, everything is permitted. And that's kind of true at one level. But actually, what we're discovering in our culture is that without God, everything is preachy, everything is religious. People thought that clearing away religion would dispense with heresy trials and witch burnings, those kind of instincts. But we've just got different heresies now, different unsayable opinions. And instead of excommunication, we now have cancel culture. It's the same thing. It's just social exclusion. It's just different phraseology and different standards of blasphemy. This temptation that we see in the Bible to self-righteousness goes very deep in human beings, whether we call ourselves religious or not. But as this trial proceeds, the true state of these leaders' hearts is exposed. It's on show for all to see. And we're going to see more of this actually next week. But they end up in chapter 19, 15, denying their allegiance to God altogether. And they say, we have no king but Caesar, which is actually a very shocking statement for religious people. So they're so keen to get rid of the true king, Jesus, they'll pledge allegiance to any tyrant who will help their cause. So we see in this section that as we try and put God in the dock, actually it bounces back. We discover that he exposes our supposed goodness for what it really is. It's just often, so often it's just self-righteousness. So having exposed our supposed goodness, next we see how Jesus also exposes our supposed neutrality. And in the next scene, the spotlight switches away from the Jewish leaders for a moment to Pilate. Pilate is the Roman governor. He's not really interested in God or theology or anything like that, or the questions of who Jesus is. None of that particularly interests him. He's just trying to do his job. He's trying to keep the peace in a very volatile political situation. So let's read again, verse 33. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? That's the key question for Pilate. Are you claiming authority and stirring up a rebellion that needs putting in its place? And Jesus answered, verse 34, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? So Pilate, I think, is a little bit like the modern day secularist. He says, look, I'm just not the religious sort. It's not really my concern what you religious people love to argue about. My concern is just to do my job. I want to keep the peace. But Jesus is about to show him there really is no such thing, actually, as the neutral, non-religious sort. We're going to see Jesus' claims of authority are so extreme, so total, in fact, that we must, by definition, be either for him or against him. There can't be a spiritual Switzerland, as it were, and we're about to see that. Just a note on structure here. We saw before that the Jewish leaders wouldn't come into Pilate's headquarters, and that's why Pilate has to keep scuttling between the Jewish leaders who are outside and then Jesus, who's inside his headquarters. And that explains why the structure of this section from verse 28 of chapter 18 all the way through to chapter 19, 16 is seven alternating scenes. Let me flag it up. So it goes from Pilate outside with the Jewish leaders in 29 to 32, then Pilate inside with Jesus, 33 to 38, then Pilate outside, then Pilate, outside, inside, outside. And I won't go into all the detail here, but it's very carefully put together. And you can see that we'll come back to the final four scenes next week to get the impact of some of this. But the effect of this outside-inside structure is that Pilate is hearing two different conflicting voices. He hears Jesus' opponents outside, then he comes inside and hears Jesus. Jesus' opponents, then Jesus. And through this process, Pilate is being pulled in two opposite directions and eventually discovers that there can be no neutral middle ground. As someone has put it, there is no neutral ground in this universe. Every square inch, every split second is claimed by God and counterclaimed by Satan. Now, if Jesus were merely a human teacher or a human king, then Pilate, I guess, could remain neutral on him. You know, he could say, well, Jesus' territory is here and it's alongside Pilate's territory and it can be quietly ignored. But Jesus does not give Pilate that option. Jesus' kingship is actually above Pilate's, so he can't ignore it. And here's where Jesus explains that. Verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." Now, at one level, Jesus' answer here, it does reassure Pilate that Jesus is not a political or a military threat. He's not trying to lead an armed uprising. And that was demonstrated, wasn't it, when Jesus told Peter to put away his sword back in verse 11. But at the same time, Jesus does claim to be the king with an authority which derives not from this world, but from God himself. This is the kingdom which Daniel, the prophet, describes in his vision in Daniel 2, a stone cut by no human hand, i.e. it's from heaven, which strikes and topples the statue of human kingdoms and then grows and becomes a mountain which fills the whole earth. This is the eternal dominion which Jesus receives in Daniel directly from the Ancient of Days in Daniel 7, a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him. And some of us have been looking at this in Revelation 1 this week in our Bible studies. And Jesus just drops that claim in here that he is a king with an authority from God himself. And in case Pilate hasn't quite grasped it yet, Jesus then translates this claim into categories which Pilate definitely can't ignore. So let's keep going. Verse 37. Then Pilate said to Jesus, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king." And the sense there is agreeing. One translation puts it, "Indeed, I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." I think it's easy to forget the context here. Jesus is a defendant on trial for his life. We mentioned that at the beginning. And yet here he is, turning the tables on Pilate, and he's putting the judge, Pilate, on trial. Jesus is telling Pilate that our response to him actually reflects back and judges ourselves. Everyone who is of the truth, or one translation, on the side of truth, listens to my voice, listens to me. Can you imagine saying that on trial for your life? I wonder if we've realized this about Jesus Christ. Everywhere he went, and now actually everywhere he's proclaimed, he confronts, he exposes people. As God himself, he is the perfect expression of love and holiness and goodness and truth. And when we read through the gospel accounts, we see a life like no other. And that is why our response to him actually reveals more about ourselves than it does about him. It's a little, just to illustrate, it's a little bit like Annabelle's biscuits. It's widely attested. Many of us will know Annabelle makes the best biscuits in the world. That's just a fact. And therefore, when I discover your response to those biscuits, it actually reveals to me a lot more about you, like whether you've got taste buds, than it does about the biscuits. Our response to the biscuits actually ends up judging ourselves, just as our response to Jesus does. So Christians try various approaches, don't they, to try and share the good news. It's their natural instinct. When you've discovered something amazing, you want everyone to know. And sometimes Christians, if they love philosophy, they start by trying to argue for the existence of God. But really, the best way to help people, if they're at all open, is letting people see Jesus. One way would be reading a gospel with someone. Have you ever looked at the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life? Why don't we, you know, look at a chapter over coffee, and maybe we could do a chapter a week if you're into it. Or we bring people to where they can hear the Bible talk, whether in person or, you know, sending them a link to a talk or whatever it is. Because what happens is, as we start looking at Jesus, as we start examining him, not only is it mesmerizing, he's amazing, but we also discover something else going on at the same time, that actually, a little bit like Pilate in this encounter, we discover that Jesus is examining us. You see, Pilate is this, he's a cynical, superstitious pagan. And when you think about it, he and Jesus have got completely different worldviews. But Jesus just cuts through all of that. And he says, well, the question is, what do you make of me? Everyone who's on the side of truth listens to my voice. Who do you think I am? And that's the question we need to be asking as well. What do you make of Jesus? It cuts through all the fog. And how does Pilate respond? Well, let's look at verse 38. Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And then this is the horrific moment. Pilate doesn't even wait for an answer. He just leaves the room. Can you imagine that? You've got a one-on-one with the Son of God, you know, the Word through whom the whole world was made. He's standing there. He's in front of you. He's ready to answer whatever questions you throw at him. And Jesus is about to answer the question, "What is truth?" And Pilate won't even wait for the answer. He's just not interested in the truth. And so once again, Jesus is the light of the world. His light shines out. And as he does so, he exposes not just our supposed goodness, but here with Pilate, he also exposes our supposed neutrality for what it really is. And he shows up what these attempts really are, just attempts to hide from the light. So we've seen that between them, the Jewish leaders and the Gentile Roman authorities, they represent really the whole world in our response, in our opposition to God. There's a guy, a friend, who Josie and I know, who was in fact the vicar who married us. And he loves asking people the question, "Are you a bandit or are you a policeman?" I don't know why he loves this question so much, but he uses it all the time. And he thinks it's, you know, the key to find out what makes people tick. And I guess all of us tend towards one of these options, don't we? Either being a bandit, either pursuing independence, just ignoring any authority over us. We're a bit like Pilate. Or we tend towards being a policeman, where we pursue moral conformity or religion, often as a way actually to avoid God, a bit like these Jewish leaders. And that's the more subtle approach to get rid of God. But what we see in this trial is that both these groups, the bandits and the policemen, the supposedly independent and neutral and the supposedly good, they're both exposed by Jesus as being deep down hostile to God, and both actually ending up sending Jesus off to his death. In fact, these Jewish and Gentile responses represent the whole world in our opposition to God. Just think for a moment, how would you conduct the experiment if you wanted to find out whether human beings are basically good, truth-loving, God-seeking creatures, or whether we're basically perverse, truth-suppressing, God-hating creatures? How would you do that experiment? Well, here's an option. What about sending the epitome of goodness and truth and integrity and wisdom and love into our midst, letting him walk about amongst us and seeing how humans respond? Well, of course, the results are in and they are not very complimentary. The point here is that the rejection of Jesus was not some perverse reaction by some particularly wicked people. We can't read this passage and go, wow, people were really bad back then. No, it was just the inevitable outworking of what is common to all humanity, our natural reluctance to submit to our Maker. And our rejection of Jesus is the exposing, defining moment, really, of what humanity are really like by nature. Now, I know this has been a very dark picture so far. It's hard to hear in some ways. But thankfully, this passage also reveals to us, and this is the second half, not just that Jesus is a light who exposes our guilt, but wonderfully, he's also the Passover lamb who deals with our guilt. So if we ask the question, why was Jesus crucified? Well, we can answer it as we have done with the human explanation, but there's a much deeper divine explanation as well. And each week in this series, we're in the third week, we've been discovering more clues about God's purpose behind Jesus' death. For example, if you were with us 2 weeks ago, we learnt back in verse 11 that Jesus is going to his death in order to, do you remember, drink the cup that the Father has given him. And we saw there that Jesus is dying to absorb the Father's righteous wrath, his anger against sin. Or if you're here last week, we saw in verse 13 that Jesus was dying as a sacrifice. As Caiaphas unknowingly prophesied, Jesus is dying for the people like a sacrificial animal. And then in our section that we're going to look at today, we get even more detail on the purpose of Jesus' death, namely that Jesus is the true Passover lamb, the one who deals with our guilt. And these aren't opposing explanations. It's actually just building up, you know, they all work together, building up one coherent picture of why it is that Jesus died. Now, at both ends of our passage, so in verse 28 and in verse 39, we're reminded all of this took place at a particular festival, the Passover. And all of the Jews would be commemorating, they'd all be thinking and celebrating that night, hundreds of years before, when they were back in slavery in Egypt, and God said he was going to send a terrible judgment on all the people, Egyptian and Israelite, because they were all deserving of God's wrath. And the judgment was going to be the death of the firstborn in every household. It's hard to imagine that kind of horror, isn't it? Just thinking in Grace Church Greenwich terms about our Sunday school, all the firstborns, Jack, Christopher, Lottie, Barnabas, Amira, and all the rest, just wiped out, devastating, doesn't bear thinking about. And yet God instructed his people that in the midst of this terrible judgment, which underlines the seriousness of human rebellion, there was an alternative. If they killed a lamb, if they put the lamb's blood on the doorpost, like in that image on the screen, when the angel of death came to kill the firstborn, he would pass over the household. He would leave them completely unharmed. And the point is that in every house in Egypt, there was a death that night. It was either the death of the firstborn or, for those who trusted God, the death of the substitute lamb instead. And in this account, John wants us to see that Jesus is, he's not only the light of the world. He's not only the one who exposes what we're really like. He's also the one, he's the lamb who can then deal with the guilt. And that is underlined in various ways in this passage. God said it had to be an unblemished lamb back in Exodus 12. And Jesus's unblemished innocence is repeatedly emphasized. Like here in verse 38, I find no guilt in him, Pilate says. The point is Jesus is innocent. And there are other links, and we're going to see more as we go through the section. Like Jesus, the Passover lamb, having none of his bones broken in verse 36, or the mention of hyssop in verse 29, and so on. And the point is that John wants us to see that Jesus really is the true Passover lamb, the one that all the festivals and the incident back in Egypt were always pointing forwards to. God's judgment will fall, but God is telling us it can fall in one of two places. It will either fall on us as we face God's wrath for our sin after we die, or if we will trust in Jesus, then the judgment for sin has already fallen on the innocent Lamb of God who died in our place. And once we have tuned into this Passover imagery, which is across the whole passage, there's another detail as well, which helps to illustrate this Passover principle and to make sure we really can't miss it. And the illustration is the final three verses of the chapter where we're going to end. So let's look at verse 38. After Pilate had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? They cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. And I guess as we've looked at this section, we've found ourselves, haven't we, this afternoon, to varying extents, we've found ourselves wearing Pilate's shoes every now and then. Yeah, I know what that feels like. Or we know perhaps we've found ourselves wearing the Jewish leader's shoes at various points. But the great news of this passage is that there are some other shoes that we can try on for size. And that is Barabbas's shoes. In fact, we are Barabbas in this section. So picture the scene. Barabbas, he's standing there in his cell. He's guilty as charged for robbery, or perhaps better, as the footnote suggests, for insurrection. He was a violent man. The other gospels include that he was a murderer. And one moment, Barabbas is stuck there in this dungeon and he's facing certain punishment for his crimes. And rightly so, he deserves everything that is coming to him. And then the next moment, he's led outside and he breathes fresh, free air. And he feels the sun on his face and he's reunited with his friends and his family. He, the guilty one, is just walking free. And yet as he looks back over his shoulder, he sees Jesus, the innocent one, on his way to be punished. And Barabbas knows that his freedom has come at a great cost to someone else. And these are the shoes that I would love all of us to walk around in and enjoy today and through the week. So next time we're walking along and we breathe fresh air into our lungs, let's consciously remember that the fresh air of our freedom from punishment comes to us only because another hung there unable to fill his lungs in our place. Next time we're outside and we're feeling this September sun on our faces, remember that the Lord's favour, which now constantly shines down on us, comes to us only because the sky turned black on the one who was God forsaken for us. Or as we meet up with friends or family over the coming weeks, whether that's online or in person, let's remember that our adoption into God's family comes to us at the price of the true Son being cast out. You see, Barabbas, his experience is our experience. We are Barabbas if we've trusted in Christ. So there really are three types of people in the world. There are people who don't yet accept point one. They will not yet accept their sin. And these are people who spend their lives minimizing or justifying themselves. They spend their times trying to avoid the light, trying to avoid scrutiny, because they don't know what to do with their sin and their guilt, and they just don't want to be exposed. There's another group, second group, who get point one. They realize that, yes, our sin is serious, and yet they just don't yet grasp point two. They insist that there must be a way that they can deal with it. Perhaps they can pay for their sin themselves somehow. They just find it too hard to accept that it could be this easy. It's just accepting a gift. They find it too tricky to receive that Jesus is our Lamb. He's done it all for us. And then finally, there is this third group who receive this truth, who know both point one and point two. And what this means is that they are a Christian. That's what it is to be a Christian. It's to understand the grace of God in all its truth, as Colossians puts it. And when that happens, when we start to receive these truths, that yes, we are sinful, and yet we can receive grace. Jesus, our Passover Lamb, has done everything necessary. When that happens, we can finally live a new life. We can finally hit escape velocity. We can be free from all the gravitational pull around us, the pull of self-denial or denial of our situation or despair or smug self-satisfaction, all these other things. And we can finally soar and be the people we were created to be. So can I encourage you today to get in the habit of putting on Barabbas's shoes? Just as you put on your own shoes in the morning, think, today I'm going to remember my true identity. I'm a forgiven sinner. And rehearse the gospel of what it is that we deserve, what we've received from God. And therefore go out into the day living lives of humble and yet confident thankfulness. Thinking how great it is to have a saviour, Jesus, and who is our dear Passover Lamb. We're going to have a moment's quiet while we come before God in thankfulness and reflect on what he's been saying to us. And then we'll have our prayers in a moment.